And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Alan Douglas Show.
If you tend to listen to radio conversation programs, and if you're listening to this one, then probably you have the habit, you've heard the airwaves crackle again and again with talk about unidentified flying objects. Talk about UFOs is like a kind of recurrent epidemic. The rash keeps breaking out time and time again. This thing, in my recollection, began back in 1946, and it took a couple of years to get into full swing. By 48, flying saucers, the pre-Air Force term for those unexplainable heavenly lights, had become front-page news. If I recall correctly, the press and the radio then treated UFO stories with a kind of a tongue-in-cheek style. Flying saucers, after all, made pretty good copy when you ran short of Capitol Hill scandals or a good hot election or a decent society murder. In the past 20 years, though, I seem to sense that the press attitude has changed. For one thing, UFO stories, by and large, don't get to the front page too much anymore. If they do, the follow-up stories drop fast to page 3 or 6 or 16. And the style seems to me to be down the middle, straight reporting. Unlike the era of the late 40s and the 50s, it now seems that a body can conceivably report an encounter with an unidentified flying object or a sighting and suffer relatively little repercussion. It is now apparent that reports about UFOs are not going to stop, and therefore it's logical to assume that the seeing of flying saucers is not a fad like the swallowing of goldfish or marathon dancing or any of those mungo crazes that are peculiar to each generation. The rash of UFO sightings and encounters continues and intensifies, and some pretty impressive, some pretty logically minded men are concerned about it. Frank Edwards, a veteran Washington newsman, a man who has earned his reputation and his livelihood from his ability to collect and evaluate pure fact, is concerned about it, and he's written an excellent book on the subject of UFOs, and with it, he is now on the nation's coveted top 10 best-selling book list for nonfiction. And you don't get there by accident. It takes some talent, and it takes some fact, and it takes some ability as a writer, I might add. His book is called Flying Saucers Are Serious Business. Earl Neff, who's appeared with us on radio several times in the past, as well as on Contact, which preceded me on WKYC, now devotes his full energies to lecturing and writing on the subject of UFOs. If you've heard Earl on the radio before, you know he's no faddist, no offbeat character. He's a very intelligent, very curious, I think rather conservative man, and I suspect that he doubts UFO stories to a greater degree than most of us until he digs out the fact from the fantasy, and then, after he's got the facts straight, only then does he form his opinion. So I think we have some rather serious-minded men with us tonight. Let me say, Frank, that Frank Edwards, I've read your book. I've read part of your book. I just started it this weekend. It's a book I have to finish. And I said before we went on the air, I just want to say it again. I said it to you before we went on so that you know I meant it. And I'll say it again so the audience can hear it. I was really hooked by this book, particularly the way it started. You get right to the crux of the matter, and in one big hurry. You're not only an interesting writer, but you raise some very alarming points.
Thank you, sir.
Particularly, you just cite one instance after another, and you tend to put down the Air Force. You tend to put them down pretty hard. Wonder how they feel about you.
They don't like me. As a matter of fact, they like me so little they once got me kicked off the network.
Yeah?
Oh, yes, 1954. I have the story documented and spelled out in detail in the book. I exposed some of the methods by which they were operating at that time, and I exposed the gross fallacies in the statements they were offering to the public, and so they put the pressure on my sponsors, a labor organization. They put the pressure on them by giving a lot of big fat contracts to non-union outfits. And, of course, this was hitting the sponsor right where they lived. And this couldn't go on very long, and it didn't. And so I lost 10 million sponsors in one night. Probably the only guy in the history of the broadcasting business who ever lost 10 million sponsors in one night, Alan.
If my attention seemed to be drifting from what I was just going down our list of sponsors tonight, and just checking things out, Brian.
You won't find the airport.
No, as a matter of fact.
At least after tonight.
I don't know. I don't. The Air Force doesn't sponsor me. If they did, I might be in more trouble than I am at the moment. Listen, I want to be sure and mention one of the big reasons that you're in Cleveland. You're in Cleveland to sell your book. And the book, I might add, is published by Lyle Stewart. I personally recommend it for anybody that wants some interesting, fascinating reading on a subject that has not bugged me to the extent that it does now since I began reading your book. I'm more bugged than I was. I was concerned and curious, and I have been known to say on the radio that I believe that it would be irreverent of any of us to assume that there's nothing out there, or that there could be nothing out there. I personally have never been blessed with a sighting, but I on the other hand, am not so irreverent as to suppose that it couldn't be a superior intelligence, one more capable than we are technologically, out there somewhere in the heavens. But this book really brings all of this into focus. And I was particularly concerned with some of your research into the past. For example, the Alexander Hamilton story. And I'd love to have you tell that to us, if you would. This goes back to when? 1897?
1897, yes. There was a wealthy farmer who was also a very prominent citizen of the state of Kansas, a member of the state legislature, and very well known throughout the state. He lived at the little town of Leroy, Kansas. And in 1897, one night, he heard quite a rumpus in the cattle lot, and he supposed that maybe one of his dogs was out there harassing the cattle. He jumped up, and his son, who was a teenage boy at the time, got up with him, and they could hear all this noise out there, and just to be on the safe side, they grabbed the nearest substitute for a weapon that they had, a couple of double-bitted axes. And they got the hired man up, and he grabbed an axe, and they all went back there. And they all signed an affidavit the following day. And they said that as they approached the cattle lot and came around behind the big barns, they saw a dirigible-shaped thing, which was red in color, and it had some sort of a cabin hanging beneath it, and some kind of a big wheel below the cabin, which was turning slowly. And in the cabin, through the transparent windows, in this brightly lighted cabin, they could see small human-like creatures, which they said were, by their standards and opinions, hideous. And these creatures seemed to be excitedly talking to each other, although they could not hear what they were saying, the farmer and his men. They found that one of his yearling cattle had a noose around its neck, and the noose was caught in a fence, or the cable was caught in a fence, and the cable went from the fence to the cabin underneath this craft, whatever it was, and the craft was obviously trying to lift this this heifer. They were trying to steal it, or just take it, I guess you'd say. Maybe they were collecting samples.
Weren't they just lifting it?
They were trying to, yeah, literally. The hired man ran over to try to chop the cable in two. He accidentally cut the fence in two, and the thing took off with the heifer dangling by the neck beneath it. They found it the following day. They found the hide and hoofs and tail in a wheat field about 7 miles away.
Frank's been talking all day.
When these fellows land, I hope they have a cure for the common cold.
I doubt it. As a matter of fact, they may have a few things we don't want. It was curious to me in 1897 that this thing was as carefully documented as it was.
As you probably noticed in the book, I carried all the list of all the bankers and doctors and lawyers and newspaper editors and everybody else who signed the affidavit that they were familiar with the character and reputation of the men involved, including Mr. Hamilton, and also with the other details of the case itself, because when the hide and hoofs were found, it was easy to identify them by, of course, by the brand. So I thought this was one of the best documented cases, and certainly one of the most bizarre cases that I ever ran across in this 20 years of research in this field.
Now, you mentioned in your book that in that year, earthbound dirigibles were not that unusual, that I guess there were some experiments going on in France, wasn't it?
No, the Zeppelins never came along. There were a few specimens extant in Europe, but they were very underpowered, and they could not possibly have crossed the...
Yeah, they certainly couldn't have come over here. Also mentioned, I guess as an aftermath of that story, the mystery that surrounded that case when the remains of this young heifer were found, what, some 3, 4, 5 miles
away? Several miles away in the middle of a wheat field, and there was no indication at all that they had been carried there. They had obviously been dropped there because there were no tracks through the wheat, which would certainly have been there had anyone walked through it.
Now, here's something I haven't as yet arrived at in your book, and I'm reading it with the kind of time that I have and the other reading that I have to do. But this is one book I want to stay with. Please tell me in advance, though. There was a period of some 20 years, you say, between 1926 and 1946 when there were no sightings.
Well, there was a period from about 26 to 46 when there were, when I have been unable to find any evidence of any sightings of objects that could be included in this UFO group.
Well, why do you suppose that 20-year period went by? Have you formed any opinion about it?
Yes, I have. I think that the reason was, in 26, we had some fairly good heavier-than-air flying machines. In fact, they seemed to be better than the objects that could not be identified. But until the operators of these things could come up with something better than we had...
Would they have had to be better?
Well... I'll tell you, Alan, if we go to another planet and find it inhabited, as we probably will do someday, we will want to be very certain that whatever we're traveling around there in is better than anything that they've got before we go in close enough and discover that we have become samples or specimens.
That's an interesting...
And I think this is what happened in our case. They had these cumbersome, dirigible-shaped things. They were not as good as our heavier-than-aircraft, so they simply disappeared. But when they came back 20 years later in 1946, they had the so-called flying saucers, which were far better than anything that we have, to this day, as a matter of fact.
Seems strange to me. The thing that I have difficulty with is understanding how extraterrestrial intelligences or intelligence could conceive a craft that would fly through space and arrive at this planet and then would find itself unable to negotiate the Earth's atmosphere and to fly through the Earth's atmosphere with the same ability that the biplanes had. It seems a little strange, but on the other hand, the whole thing is strange, so I don't know why I find that difficult to believe. In a moment, I want to ask Frank Edwards, and we have Frank Edwards with us tonight, who is the author of Flying Saucers, A Serious Business. Time magazine said you're number, what, 7 or 6?
6 now.
Number 6 on the non-fiction best-selling list.
On page 81 in one issue, they blasted me, and on page 4 of the same issue, they promoted me from 10th. The 6th place.
There seems to be no relationship between their reviews and the status of the book. Look at Harold Robbins, who I don't think has ever had a good review from Time magazine. I don't want to compare you to Harold Robbins, of course, but he seems to get up there pretty fast. I don't think they had much to say good about Valley of the Dolls either, which has been on the number 1 spot in fiction, I guess.
Oh, for months and months.
It's going to get a record if it keeps going. With us also is Mr. Earl Neff. Mr. Neff is a lecturer and ufologist, a writer who's coming out with a book of his own very shortly.
Friday
it comes out.
Eerie.
It's a compilation of UFO evidence, and a very interesting book that Earl has put together. We'll talk about that. And we'll also get to this question that I want to ask Mr. Edwards, and this has to do with the blackout situation last year and some of the reported blackouts in the past. Some very curious information comes to us by way of Mr. Edwards' book, which gets back into that blackout controversy of last year, and it wasn't anywhere near as much of a controversy as it apparently begins to be in Frank's book. Frank Edwards just autographed a book for Earl Neff, and it reads, "Don't read this book after dark." We will we'll get to these questions in just a moment. Frank, you all right now?
42 years in the broadcasting business, and I forget to look out for the open mic.
You know, Alan...
42 years this year, really.
Well, it's kind of a novel experience.
Now, when I get accustomed to it, I'll be all right.
You know, Alan, when Frank arrived here this afternoon and he called me, he said, "This is Frank," and I said... Frank, who? And I couldn't recognize the voice. And, you know, the first thing you knew, I was talking just like he was. I was catching it.
Mm.
He's got it that bad.
Well, Frank was down at the Higby Company today, and he's been talking all day long. As a matter of fact, I was over there, too, working another part of the showroom, and I could hear him. And he was doing great. And he had everybody all spellbound. And I don't know how long a man can go, you know, without beginning to run out of voice, even a man as strong and as capable as Frank Edwards. And when so notable a personage as Mr. Edwards comes into town, we're delighted to have him. Now, let's get to this blackout business, Frank.
Where would you like to start, Alan?
I'd like to start last fall, 1965, with the East Coast blackout.
November the 9th.
Yeah.
Well, when that thing happened... The organization of which I'm one of the members of the Board of Governors, NICAP, which I'm sure Earl has often mentioned here on this show, this is the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. We immediately got in touch with some of our members and consultants up in that part of the country, particularly at the universities around Syracuse and Ithaca and up in there. And we had them get on the job right now to determine whether or not there was any real evidence of any UFO activity there at the time of the blackout. Now, there were some UFOs in the area, a couple at least. One of them was pictured on the front page of the Syracuse paper the next day. But there was absolutely no evidence to connect the UFOs with the big blackout. Now, I know this is at variance with a statement that is sometimes credited to me and always credited to a fellow who has written another UFO book, but I repeat that there was no evidence that NICAP's consultants could find that would indicate that the UFOs had any part in that particular blackout, the big one, although they have very definitely been important factors in some other blackouts, but not in the big one of last November the 9th.
But there were many fireball sightings.
Oh, yes, that? Yes. There were some fireball sightings. But none of these objects that were sighted up there on that particular night, Alan, were where they could have caused the blackout. It apparently was exactly what it was described as being, a breakdown of some very delicate and intricate machinery and equipment that just simply didn't function properly, and as a result, it spread rapidly from one place to another until it just paralyzed that whole New England area. But at NICAP, we are confident that the UFOs did not play an important part in that one at all.
Then there was a just an atmosphere of what, hysteria about the stories, and there were these stories that...
Unfortunately, there were some people peddling these stories, and some who should have known better.
Mm.
And I know one newspaper ran an 8-column banner head in which they said that the UFOs had caused this, and they quoted a guy who professed to be a UFO authority. Well, if he was a UFO authority, he was more of an authority on UFOs than he was on truth, because there was absolutely nothing to his story whatever. I never heard of the guy before or since, which is all right with me.
Well, now, how do you distinguish between fact and fantasy? You've got a tremendous amount of fact in this book, and you write beautifully about it. But how do you determine the difference between what is valid and what's not? How does Frank Edwards make this decision?
Well, in the book now, you must remember that in this new book of mine, that is really the result of 20 years of study and research, and certain patterns develop, Alan. You soon realize that there are certain things that are true of these UFOs and certain things that are not true of them. So when somebody comes up with a big story about how they were met by a golden girl in some uranium coveralls out in the edge of the desert, and she took them into this thing, and they flew to Venus, and they came back, and this guy goes around making speeches. Even if you know very little of the fundamentals, you would suspect such a story. But if you know the facts, you can quickly check out the things that aren't right, and which plainly point out to you that the story's full of discrepancies. The same thing is true of photographs. UFOs have come in a few very easily recognizable shapes and sizes. And when you get these pictures, for instance, there's one now, there's a color photograph being sold, supposedly, of a UFO. As a matter of fact, it's a hubcap suspended from a nylon fish line between two trees. And it's been photographed from different sides and in color, and it's being sold to the gullible. But anyone who...
How can you tell it's a hubcap?
Because I know the guy who did it.
Well, that's cheating.
That's very helpful. But I would have suspected it being a hubcap anyhow.
Hmm.
Because, first place, the nature of the photograph makes it suspect. It's too conveniently dangled between two trees.
It's too composed.
Yeah, it looks like something that just didn't happen.
Well, now you talk about hubcaps. How about this picture that was taken?
The Heflin picture?
Yeah, the Heflin picture in Los Angeles County. That doesn't look like a hubcap. I don't know. What difference do you draw between this picture or this series of pictures? Is it the guy's story?
Let me explain what the pictures are. On the night of August 2nd and 3rd last year, about 250,000 people stood out in the open between the Canadian border and the border of Mexico, and they watched strange lighted objects maneuvering around in the sky. These things flew around and under and over various commercial planes. They were photographed in color and black and white.
Mm-hmm.
They were seen on radar. They were tracked. They were seen by police and airport people and commercial flyers, everybody else. And the following morning, this Rex Heflin, who is a man with an excellent reputation, he's a minor official in the Los Angeles County Highway Department, he was driving along on Mitford Road near Santa Ana, California. He'd gone to photograph the scene of a fatal wreck the night before. He had a loaded Polaroid camera on the seat of his truck, and he saw this object, this disc-shaped thing, coming toward him across the field.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very foggy morning, or hazy, as they call smoggy, pardon me. And this thing came and stopped over the road in front of him. He stopped, and he made three pictures in all, one out the windshield and two out the side door of the truck. The Air Force looked at some copies of the original, and they said, why, this is nothing, just a hoax. This man has sailed a hat out there and photographed it. Now, we got some experts from two of the aviation companies out there, and United Press had also done the same thing. We sent men down there with the same equipment to make the same kind of picture under the same conditions. And they found out that you could make that picture by sailing a hat, but the hat had to be slightly larger than a Volkswagen.
That's a pretty big hat.
Frank, may I also inject this to Alan, the fact that the radio of Rex's was malfunctioning during that time, other radios as well.
Yes.
So that's not a phony picture.
Alan, the important thing in that picture was something that the Air Force didn't mention. You notice in the first picture where the object is hovering over the shoulder of the road, you notice the white patch on the shoulder of the road?
Yes.
Now, when you magnify the original picture, you can see that this disturbance directly underneath the object consists of particles of dust and gravel and sticks and stuff jumping up in the air about a foot or 15 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a common characteristic of the gravitational disturbance under these UFOs when they are at low altitude.
Yes.
And it was not mentioned by the Air Force for pretty obvious reasons. But the minute I saw the picture, I looked for that, and there it was.
Mm.
Because I have so many reports where highly credible and competent witnesses have noticed this same peculiarity, the same phenomenon, under the objects when they're at low altitude. And there they are in that picture.
But as I look at this picture, I can't be absolutely sure that that object is directly over the disturbance on the shoulder of the road.
It is not directly over it, but a vertical axis through the object
goes down
toward that, yes.
I'd also like to point out that the winds on this particular stretch of countryside near Santa Ana, California, are reputedly pretty strong and pretty weird. And I'm not doubting now your belief in this picture, but I would like to point out that apparently the belief that you place in these things must have a great deal to do with the individual who reports it, the individual who takes the picture.
Yes, very definitely. Now, before the United Press distributed this picture, they did two things.
Mm-hmm.
They conducted a thorough check into this man's background, his reputation, his standing with his superiors, and they checked him out thoroughly, and he checked out A1, and then they also checked out the picture and the equipment that was used, and they came to the same conclusion that NICAP did, that this man photographed something very unusual under the conditions that he described.
No, it doesn't seem that a rationally minded, dependable man, a responsible man, would driving along the road near Santa Ana, California, suddenly stop and do something as kooky as staging a phony UFO picture.
No, that wouldn't be a good place for it.
I'll buy that.
And Alan, also, I think we ought to credit the NICAP people out in that area, because NICAP, in case people don't just know what we're talking about, the National Investigations Committee on Air Phenomena, Frank is one of the board members of, and they have a very large organization. Not only this country is represented, but all 50 foreign countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that naturally, when something of this kind happens, it's only natural that the people in the area closest are going to check it out. And again, they did that here. And also the Air Force did mention that this picture showed that the man had focused on a closer by object that the distance was out of focus. This most certainly was not true. The Air Force claimed it was, but it's definitely not, because I got one of these pictures the minute it got off the wires here.
Well, we had some photographic engineers from both North American and Convair out there go out and examine the scene and make efforts to duplicate it. And they provided us with some very thorough but highly technical reports, which said that the Air Force summation on this thing was completely invalid because it was at variance with the laws of optics and also with the known facts in the case.
If there is one chapter that is really a cliffhanger, and one that I think everybody will find most attractive and most absorbing, it's the chapter called Who's Driving, in which you speak of encounters, descriptions of encounters, those creatures inside the machines. And the thing that really stuck with me, one of the striking stories, I think, is the one of, is it Jose Ponce and Gustavo Gonzalez? On when was this, November 28th, in what year?
57, I think.
57?
Yeah.
That's a wild story. And apparently, this thing has all kinds of proliferations. There are people around the area apparently saw elements of the same thing.
Yes, very definitely. It happened in Venezuela.
This was in Venezuela?
Yeah, wasn't it? Wasn't that the one just outside Caracas?
Oh, yes, Caracas.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now tell us about that story.
Well, these two fellows whom you just mentioned were in the vegetable business down there, and each morning, very early in the morning, they would get in their truck. They had a new truck, and they'd get in this truck and go out to a little farming community of Patares, which is just outside Caracas. They'd go out there and load up with the vegetables for the market, which they would bring in to their customers in the market. On this particular morning, they got into the beautiful residential section of Caracas, and they noticed this glowing, lighted thing over the road, hovering over the road about 4 or 5 feet above the road, or I should say the street. They got to within about 50 or 60 feet of it with their truck, and their engine died on the truck, and their lights went out. And they could all they could see was this brightly lighted thing motionless there above the street. Well, the two of them got out of the truck and walked slowly toward this thing to determine what it was. They had never seen anything like it before. Suddenly, they told police, they found themselves set upon by some small man-like creatures. And one of these men said that he was knocked down, and he got to his knee, and he was between this creature and the craft, or the UFO. And the creature was evidently trying to get by him or get around him to get to the craft. But he thought it was attacking him, and it may have been. At any rate, he pulled his knife, and as this small man-like creature made a lunge at him, he stabbed at it with the knife, and he tried to stab it in the shoulder. He said he might as well have stabbed a rock, because his knife glanced off of it. And he said he thought that he was done, that this was the end of it. As a few seconds later, he was scrambling around on his hands and knees there, and he saw his partner running down the street away from the scene, and he got up and followed him. They only had to go about 3 blocks to a police station. When they got in the police station, they were in such a state of shock that the police thought they were drunk. They examined them and tried to talk to them, and they finally got them quieted down and took down the details of it and went back down there with them. The truck was sitting there. The lights of the truck were back on, but the engine was dead, although the ignition was turned on, and this object, this UFO, was gone. Well, this would have been just another case had it not been for the fact that one of the best-known obstetricians in Caracas had been just about a block behind these men. He had been to a hospital on a case and was on his way home. He saw their truck stop. He saw the object hovering over the street, and he stopped to see what this was all about. He saw the fight and saw the whole thing, and then saw the thing take off. After the men took off for the police station, he saw the little fellows, the humanoids, get into this craft and saw it take off. And he went to the police station and actually got there before these men got away, and he examined them and determined for the police that they were not drunk but were in a state of shock. He later gave sworn statements to the government of Venezuela, and as I note in the book, a very interesting coincidence, on the following day, some of the top newsmen from the United States showed up in Caracas. And whether it was mere coincidence or not, I don't know, but it's strange that they should be there. And this doctor, this obstetrician, was questioned by a delegation of Air Force intelligence men who were sent to Caracas. He was questioned at great length, as were the two truck drivers. And the doctor, according to a newspaper in Venezuela, was later flown to this country and for further questioning.
And where'd you dig this story up, Frank? This is I had never heard of this, but why? This happened, when, 57, 58?
Yeah.
Why didn't we read about that in this country?
That's a very good question, and the only ones I know who could answer that question would be the wire services, because the story was carried in scores of South American papers and Latin American papers. I never saw the story carried in any paper in this country, and I got the whole story by having the wire service accounts for South America translated. Why it was not carried here, I don't know.
But you know, the closer you get to Cleveland, the less you learn about UFOs.
Why
this
is that?
Has been a known fact. Because
why?
Our papers, well, in the first place, we don't have any competition here. Years ago, we had 3 papers, the News, the Press, and the Plain Dealer. Today, we just have 2. And apparently they're afraid to handle a subject. I've known of very good stories that are handed to the papers by professional writers, and they're scared apparently of them, or else there's censorship or something, I don't know. But the further you get away from Cleveland, the more you're likely to find good articles.
Well, now, this is not necessarily due to lack of competition. I live in Indianapolis, as you know, Earl,
yes.
And we have as little competition in the newspaper business there as you can conceive, because there are only 2 papers, and both of them are owned and operated by the same man. So he has no competition at all, but he does a pretty good job of covering the UFO subject. And just last week, the editor of the evening paper, the Indianapolis News, ran a 3-column story on the editorial page about a UFO which he and his neighbors had watched the night before. So it must be the difference in coverage, must be the difference in personalities.
The personalities have a big part to play. We have people in this town who would not believe a flying saucer, even if it landed on their desk. I mean, in the newspapers, this I know, and all you have to do is read your so-called science columns in your paper and you'll find out in a hurry. In other words, we have Dr. Menzels, you might say, in this area.
Dr. Menzels?
Yes, Menzel was the foremost of the poo-poo artists, you might say, of the UFO.
He wrote two books, Alan. He wrote two books to prove that there are no such things. In other words, he wrote two books about nothing. If you don't think so, read them.
Frank one time said that he could use the same kind of logic that Menzel uses to prove that he didn't exist.
Yes, you could use the same kind of same treatment that Menzel uses of UFOs. You could prove that Menzel doesn't exist.
How does book sell?
Not very well.
Well, of course, I'm far be it for me to question a man's motives. But on the other hand, I guess if you write a book that proves the existence of nothing, then one can expect to do about the same thing.
Sales volume of nothing.
I guess I don't know whether that attests to the actual existence of UFOs or not. But I must say that where something persists from biblical days, and there's early in Frank's book, he comes to the Bible and finds references in the Bible which could easily be translated into UFO sightings and associations with creatures from some extraterrestrial source, as easily as some of the claims, and more easily than some of the claims that I have seen put to the Old Testament.
Alan, I think the strongest case that I make in the book for the existence of UFOs and their operators, it's simply the numerous quotations that I have in there from our own government and from other governments,
mm-hmm.
pointing out the title of the book is taken from an Air Force order.
Mm-hmm.
Flying Saucers, Serious Business. That's the title of the Air Force order. I've got a page in there from an Air Technical Intelligence Manual alerting their people to a new type of UFO coming into use in 1953. I've got statements in there from the British government, from the French, from the government of South Africa, from Argentina, from Chile, from Brazil, all these places. Official statements on experiences that they've had with UFOs.
Well, it's curious to me that these statements come from people who are, in one case, retired. Here's the Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding, who is the head of the Royal Air Force in World War II. It was quoted by Reuters, August of 54. He said, of course, the flying saucers are real, and they're interplanetary. Here is, and this is curious, Secretary of the Air Force to Base Commanders, 1960. The Air Force maintains a continuous surveillance of the atmosphere near Earth for unidentified flying objects. Of course, he didn't say there's anything out there. He's looking, I guess. But it's curious to me that these are people who are once removed from positions of authority as we think of it.
In their official capacity as acting members of the government,
mm-hmm.
they had to know what the government knew about this. Now that they are retired, most of them join NICAP, I'll tell you that. And they do it because they know that we are trying to get the government to reveal to the public the truth, whatever it may be.
There's a curious statement from the Honorable John McCormick, Speaker of the House, January 65. Mr. McCormick says, I feel that the Air Force has not been giving out all the available information on these unidentified flying objects. You cannot disregard so many unimpeachable sources. That seems to be, pretty much it. When the Air Force goes up or sends someone like, who is it, Professor Hynek?
Yeah.
Up
yeah.
to Hillsdale, Michigan, and comes back with a story about swamp gas. I must say that I must be one of the most unobservant creatures on Earth, because I've spent a lot of time creeping and crawling through swamps. And I, at night, and I have never seen, this in the service, I don't do this as a rule, but I've never seen this alleged swamp gas, and I think I've seen them under pretty good atmospheric conditions.
Well, it comes with the red and blue lights now, you know.
Oh, I see. Is that it? This is something entirely new.
Well, the Michigan swamp gas are all have windows in it.
Yeah, and it's like Frank speaks in his book there of the galloping volcanoes on the moon. I mean, these are among the rare type, but that's what causes those lights up there, you know.
Well, you know, Alan, the Air Force made a classic boo-boo in August the 3rd of last year when they told all those tens of thousands of people out there in the Great Plains states that they had been watching nothing more than four stars in the constellation Orion. Well, the newspapers took offense at this because professional astronomers quickly pointed out that that constellation at that time was visible only from the other side of the Earth. So by the time this thing happened at Hillsdale, Michigan in 66, I had a collection of over 300 angry editorials demanding that the Air Force stop this nonsense and tell the public the truth. Well, then when they bombed out with that swamp gas story up in Michigan, they literally blew themselves out of the business of being a credible source of explanations on UFOs, because they had completely discredited themselves. And most of the moves that the Air Force has made since then have been moves in the direction of trying to restore some measure of their former stature as a source of information on this subject. But I don't think they're doing too well, because last week they fathered one. Could the UFOs be luminous flying ants?
How's that?
Could the UFOs be luminous flying ants?
I thought I heard you.
Yes, well, I don't really see how they could be luminous flying ants if you're going to chase them with jet interceptors. Because generally speaking, that would be pretty rough on the ants, if you could find them.
One would have to admit that you could not catch a luminous flying ant with a jet interceptor.
How would you know when you had it?
Except that I don't know how you saw it. You certainly would commit one of the massive flybys of all time, I would judge.
And then they had another one they put out through an aviation magazine recently. A theory, very careful with all this stuff, a theory that the UFOs were corona discharges from high-tension lines. This, too, is one of the... could be in the swamp gas category.
You know, Alan, a few years back in the 50s, the Air Force wasn't quite as talented then as they are now with their replies, but they explained this angel hair that had festooned itself from telegraph pole to telegraph pole downstate for several miles as being a certain type of spider that had worked that particular night. Now, those spiders were so busy that the shop owners had to sweep away all this angel hair from their shop window, their doorways the following morning. Had they known that by just leaving it for a little while, it would disappear, sort of like if you have a heavy snow in the winter, you can wait till July and then not have to shovel it. But this was only for a matter of a couple hours, and it was all gone. A girl I know used to live down there near Columbus when this occurred. You could catch it in your hands. Your hands would maybe turn sort of a clammy cold and turn green for the time being. But yet this was the spider that was working very industriously that particular night.
Yeah, I think it's in your book that I read this observation, Frank, and that is that the Air Force never asked for this job of...
That's correct.
...of UFO identification.
Yes, sir. That's right. This thing was handed to the Air Force. Actually, you know, the Air Force inherited the whole problem from the Army Air Corps. In 1947, when the UFOs, the so-called flying saucer form, began to appear in numbers over the United States, it was the Army Air Corps. And the Army Air Corps was completely flabbergasted by the phenomena with which they had to cope. And they said, they announced on July 3rd of 47 that it was nothing but a form of hallucination. And they couldn't have picked a worse day for the announcement, because on July the 4th, the following day, about 100,000 people stood out in the streets of Portland, Oregon, and watched 10 of these things maneuvering around overhead. And if those people were having hallucinations, their cameras were having them too, because they could photograph them, and they did. And the Air Force was, the Air Corps was just simply befuddled with the whole thing. But I think they were on the right track. You see, at that time, we were only 9 years away from the Orson Welles and his War of the Worlds thing, which created mass hysteria and panic and induced quite a few suicides and some large, juicy lawsuits that had to be settled out of court. And so the government was, the Army Air Corps was probably on the right track. The newspapers were playing these things up day after day after day on the front pages. And there was a growing tension in the public mind and a lot of excitement. A lot of people were getting unnecessarily excited about this. And so the decision to play it down until they found out what it was probably a very good decision at the time. Then when the Air Force came into being on January the 1st, 1948, they had only been in business as the Air Force for 7 days when they lost a pilot at Fort Knox, Kentucky. There were three of them sent up after this huge UFO, which was being observed crossing the state of Kentucky coming toward Fort Knox. And these three planes were up, and they were sent up to close on this thing. Two of them ran out of fuel and had to go back, but this one, Captain Thomas Mantell, got close to the object, and he said, "I'm close enough to see that it's spherical, that it's huge, that it's metal," and he said, "I'm going to try to close on it." Well, he was never heard from again. We presume that he perished up there from lack of oxygen, although this would be very strange for a veteran fighter pilot like him to make that kind of a mistake. At any rate, he died, and they said that night at Fort Knox, they held a press meeting, and they said Captain Mantell was killed in pursuit of a flying saucer.
Was the plane found?
The plane was found, yes. It was it was pretty badly torn up in the air. The pieces of it were scattered around. This is another peculiar thing as to why that particular type of plane, which I recall was a P-51, would come apart even in a power dive, because they just didn't do that, so the flyers tell me. I had a friend who was one of the other two members in that group, and he said, "This is preposterous." He said, "You could dive one of those things wide open as far as she'd go, and it was built like a locomotive. It just wouldn't come apart." But his had come apart, and it was pretty badly scattered. He was killed, of course. But in 1952, when these things swarmed over Washington, D.C. in such numbers that the Civil Aeronautics Administration published a special book on how many of them were over Washington on those nights, what they looked like, and especially what they looked like on the radar. They published a special book on the thing. Well, the government found itself in a very ticklish position. It was here dealing with something which it could not control. Here was the government of the biggest nation on earth and the most powerful and the best armed, having visitors in the air over the national capital with which it could not cope. It had to do one of two things. It either had to admit this failure, this inability to cope with these things, or it had to pretend that there was no such problem while all the time it tried to find the answers. I think that was, of course, the decision they chose. I think it was a good one at the time. I don't think there's anything wrong about that at the time. This was when the Air Force got the assignment to conduct all the investigations and to make the only public statements on UFOs. No other government agency can do it. And the Air Force was further restricted so that they could tell the public only that these things were conventional objects or conditions. That restriction has never been lifted. The assignment is still there. The Air Force still has the order, that assignment, and they still have that restriction on them. And I think the Air Force has done a good job within the restrictions. But I think it's time that the restrictions were lifted and that the Air Force was permitted to tell the public whatever it is that it knows about these things and stop feeding us swamp gas.
Alan, what leads you to believe, or do you believe, that they know anything more than you know?
Oh, I'm sure they do, because they have had access to pieces of these things. They may have had access to some very sizable pieces of the things. They have spent, by their own admission, $10 million investigating these things. I got a big laugh out of Walter Sullivan in the New York Times recently. He fell for that old Air Force guff that all that they had to in the investigation was one commissioned officer and a sergeant and somebody else.
Yeah.
Well, if that's true, what did they do with the $10 million which they admitted 5 months ago that they had spent investigating these things? How do three men spend $10 million? investigating anything, for that matter.
Really?
Right over these microphones, some years ago, you know Admiral Hillenkoetter, Admiral, Vice Admiral Herbert B. Knowles.
Yeah.
And I had Knowles on here, and Knowles was in Washington at the very time that Frank's talking about, when the UFOs were there. In
July of 52.
That's right. And that's when Dr. Wilbur Smith, the late Dr. Wilbur Smith, the Project Magnet of Canada, was also there. And Wilbur Smith actually handed to Knowles, Knowles said this himself, Admiral Knowles, a piece of metal 2 feet long, curved, that had been shot down by anti-aircraft fire. This, under the microscope, every little particle looked like a solar system. It was a shiny piece of metal. And Knowles said that, yes, it's true, that about 10 days, 2 weeks later, it was a dirty brown, apparently due to our atmosphere.
Well, I have a statement from Wilbert Smith, who headed the Canadian investigation. He said that this thing was shot, he was told by the Air Force, that this piece which they gave him had been shot off of a small UFO over Maryland near Washington, D.C. during these July 52 sightings. And he said that this, they analyzed the piece that was given to them up in Canada. They analyzed part of it, and they found that it was iron. And it was conventional iron by our standards, with one exception. Instead of having a crystalline structure, it had a very fine globular structure. I believe he said 0.005 microns. That was the size of the tiny little spherical particle. And he said he didn't understand how these particles hung together. We can understand how crystalline structures hang together. It's a sort of a felted action. But he said they couldn't understand how these tiny little globular particles of iron held together. But he said other than that, that there was nothing unusual about the piece.
That it would have been the treatment of the steel.
Could have been,
or
yes.
The tempering process.
Something.
I have a piece of metal that is not my own possession. It's in my possession, but I don't own it. And this, too, is iron, reportedly from one of these. It's so hard it'll cut glass, yet there's not a trace of carbon in it. I've had spectrographic analysis of it. Washington is just dying to get a hold of it. I told them they could have it if I went with it.
Mm-hmm. Was it lighter?
It's very heavy.
It's heavy?
It's very heavy. It will not rust. It's very shiny. It looks like it's been polished, parts of it, or it's mm-hmm. been cut. Very, very difficult to cut. Takes a molybdenum blade a long time to cut through a piece.
Very curious thing. I would like to know just what you think these things are and just where you feel we're going. Frank Edwards, in his book, writes of the next UFO phase, and on the dust jacket it reads, its unprecedented implications for the human race. And I think we're all pretty curious about that. So we'll find out from Frank Edwards what he means by that, and then we'll open our telephones and let you find out what else you want to know. From Frank Edwards, author of Flying Saucers, Serious Business, published by Lyle Stewart, now available at better bookstores everywhere and not-so-good bookstores anywhere, and just about anywhere you choose to go. It's on the bestseller list. Also, Mr. Earl Neff, who is with us tonight. Mr. Neff is a Cleveland ufologist and lecturer and writer. My name is Alan Douglas, and I just sit and listen. And I do this every night to my own great glee and financial pleasure on WKYC AM and FM NBC in Cleveland. Now, Frank, just what is it? What new era do you look forward to? And what do you think these things are?
Well, let me say first, in answer to this double-barrel question, I think I agree with all the scientists with whom I'm associated in NICAP. And so far as I know, they are all of the same opinion on this, that these craft are spacecraft. Notice that I don't say interplanetary. They are spacecraft, and that they are operated by intelligent beings, that the ones who actually operate them are not necessarily the ones who conceived and directed the program, and that they have been coming here for a long time. I agree with Al Chop, the Deputy Public Relations Director of NASA, that we have known for a long time that these things have had us under systematic surveillance. Apparently, they are not hostile, and apparently, if they are going to contact us, we are getting very close to that point. Does that answer your question?
Sure does. I just thought I'd leave that go for dramatic pause. That's quite a point. You think we're getting close?
Yes, I do. And one of the things that makes me think that is the fact that each time these things are reported around one of our spacecraft, they come a little closer and stay a little longer. And this couldn't be accidental.
You know, Alan, back in April the 8th, I think it was, of 65, we had four UFOs come and follow one of our Gemini two-man experimental capsules. It had just left the Cape, left the launching pad. Two went above it, one went below it, one went behind it. They followed this capsule for one complete orbit of the Earth, then off into space they went again. Apparently they had learned their mission was accomplished. I don't know what their mission was, but their curiosity was certainly probably satisfied. But I spent quite a bit of time very recently with Major Kehoe. Some of the things he told me that particular day, I have every reason to feel now we are getting much closer than we ever have been before to a big breakthrough. The fact that they're coming here in various 1968 models makes me think that probably they have, like Frank said before, realized that we too are getting a bit further ahead in our technology, and they have to keep a little bit further abreast. The ones that were seen in 52, the Farmer Trent type of saucer, is no longer seen very much. But I would like to say this, that for people who are seriously concerned in this area with learning more about this kind of subject, that people who, like NICAP and APRO, approach it very seriously and from an objective standpoint, meet every third Saturday of the month. This particular Saturday will be that third Saturday. And I will show there for the very first time something that the public will not receive in book form until June of next year, when the publisher will release the book. It's a beautiful book that's being published in Washington, or rather has been authored in Washington. And I've done the illustrations for them, and I will on the screen this Saturday night at the Cleveland Ufology Project.
Where are you going to meet there?
This is at the Cuyahoga Savings and Loan Company. It's on Pearl Road, just one block beyond Snow as you're leaving the city. And we meet there at 8 o'clock, and I'll show these 12 on the screen for the very first time. And one of them, I might say, Frank, has familiarized me much more with this marvelous story that you told so beautifully before. The one of the heifer raised in the air.
Are these things you're going to show, are they photographs or are they drawings?
These are illustrations, these are drawings that I have made of the very early sightings wherever they occurred.
Mm.
And I feel that the organization, we're an old organization. In fact, I think was perhaps one of the first organizations of its of UFO groups to use the word ufology. They started back in 1957. I became their first chairman in 58, served a couple terms, and our founders are still with us. We're a good, solid organization, and I feel that the people who belong there, like C. Wesley Fitch, whom I noticed, Frank, you have credited in your book, who is a great personal friend of mine. These are people who are very seriously and objectively approaching it. He's one of the finest investigators in the nation.
Who coined the term UFO? Was it the Air Force term?
Yes. So it should be. It's the right term. You notice in my book I refer to them as UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Only the very early ones, the 46 and 47 up to late 53 models, were actually saucer-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
They looked like inverted saucers, and they were phased out, as the Air Force points out in its Air Technical Intelligence Manual in September of 53. The disc-shaped, the saucer-shaped things were being phased out and being replaced by a single and sometimes a double convex type of craft, and they printed the picture, which I carry in my book there, to alert their personnel to the fact that a new type was coming into use.
This is a clear picture of what isn't there, isn't it?
Yeah, a clear picture of a swamp gas, a double convex swamp gas.
All right.
And because of the different shapes involved, unidentified flying object is a more inclusive and more appropriate term.
Well, let me say that I think the term has also been beautifully glamorized. It may be just another Air Force term for something, but I would suggest that people like yourselves, Frank Edwards and Earl Neff, have done a lot to make it an intriguing term.
I wanted to ask Mr. Edwards, who incidentally I enjoyed very much listening to on TV when I was younger.
Why do they always have to add that?
I don't know, but I got a letter the other day from a guy who wanted to bring his grandson to meet me, and it developed that the grandpa used to listen to me in Pittsburgh when he was a boy.
It's a great sadness, ma'am. You've hurt this man deeply, but go ahead with your question.
Sorry about that.
I'm grieving now.
What I wanted to ask is, do you believe that the Air Force will take off their restrictions? And why do they keep holding them now? I mean, people are getting more enlightened. They're not getting as hysterical as they were back when Orson Welles was doing all these things. And why don't they take the restrictions off?
Well, let me put this in its proper perspective here. The Air Force did not impose the restrictions. They were imposed on the Air Force from some higher source. My guess would be the National Security Council. So the Air Force cannot remove the restrictions which were imposed upon it, but I think they would gladly, in all probability, they would gladly tell the public the truth if they were permitted to. But they can only go so far. And that's what I do in my book, is to tell the public what the Air Force is not permitted to tell them. And I don't think the Air Force can make any change until the change is made for it, although I feel that they probably would like to make it.
I see. And one more question I'd like to ask. Is your book going to come out in paperback?
Eventually, yes. I really don't know when, but Bantam Books bought the paperback rights to it. And I really don't know when it will come out in paperback.
Yeah, because I've got a paperback budget, so I'll wait until it's in.
It follows as...
Mine is a paperback.
It follows as the night shall fall of a day that all books will come out in paperback.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Douglas?
Yes.
Yes, I can hardly hear you.
Well, I hear you beautifully.
All right, thank you. I would like to know from either of the gentlemen there, please, what their opinion would be of the author of The Anatomy of a Phenomenon by Jacques Vallée.
Yes, he treats it from the standpoint of an astronomer. There are some aspects of it with which he is obviously unfamiliar, but the research that he did was good, and his treatment of the subject is logical and very intelligent, as it should be from a man of his caliber.
In their experiences and their studies and research on it, what is their idea of the Fatima incident?
I have no opinions on that at all. In the first place, I'm not familiar with it. I regarded it as for what I think it is, some sort of a religious, curious religious story. And I have never formed any opinions or conclusions on it. I saw a book somewhere, and I don't know whose book it was now. It may have been Vallée's, which treated the Fatima incident as though it might be involved with UFOs. But on the basis of what I know of it, I doubt that, and I certainly don't know enough about it to arrive at the same conclusion. Let's put it that way.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
We have a long-distance call, and let's move to our telephone and see what this party wants to know or wants to tell us. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering, since Mr. Edwards and Mr. Neff are associated with NICAP, I have a publication from NICAP in which there is a statement that on December 4th, from Antigua, Gemini 7 astronauts report bogey at 10 o'clock. Now, did they actually see something?
Who were the astronauts?
I don't know. It's not mentioned.
I think this was Borman. I believe this was the Borman case. He was one of the astronauts. In that case, they tried to assure him from the base station that he was looking at a booster rocket, and he said, right, you are. I see the booster rocket in one direction, but this bogey is in another. And he said that this bogey is definitely not a booster rocket nor a satellite. He said this is a football-shaped or egg-shaped thing. It's yellowish-orange in color and very bright. Now, if that description was accurate, then it would also fit the description of the object which was photographed by Major McDivitt when he was up there with Major White, and they saw three of these things in one orbit, and he made an excellent picture of one which was circling their capsule and leaving a vapor trail behind it, which shows clearly in the picture. I got the picture from NASA, and I have it in my book.
Was circling their capsule?
Yes.
Didn't Scott Carpenter also have an hallucination?
I don't know whether Carpenter did or not, but I know that Major Gordon Cooper was the first one, and then Borman was the next one, and then White and McDivitt,
yeah.
And then more recently Collins and Young. And while they were describing the two that were pacing them, they were cut off the radio. This, of course, I was interested in Brinkley's comment on that. He said, well, Collins and Young were cut off, so they couldn't describe it anymore. And the newsmen couldn't hear it, but he said, don't worry, boys. The Air Force would have told you it was swamp gas.
Well, it's always interesting how they'll tell you that no such object can be recorded as a UFO on radar, and yet thousands and thousands of the boys, thousands have been seen by the boys.
Well, the only statement of that type, to my knowledge,
CBS special.
Yeah, it was made on that thing, and they edited the rest of the statement out off of the tape by the authority who made it to change the entire meaning of what the man said.
Sure.
Now, before you said that one of these objects was it McDivitt's sighting, was circling the capsule, I was going to say that there are literally thousands of pieces of hardware up there. No.
All of which are known to NORAD and are plotted, and NORAD knows where they are and what they are.
Even the glove.
All the time.
Mm. Even the glove that was lost, they can plot.
Okay, that puts me down. How about you, ma'am?
That was very interesting. I've been having a running battle with someone, and that might help.
All right, well,
ammunition.
Try if you can to get along with your husband.
I'm afraid he is quite a skeptic.
Well, let me point out to you that this is a field where the only skeptics are the uninformed. You may quote me to him, and that'll get you off.
I will use that. I also have an article that I have picked up. I don't know whether you are familiar with it. It was in August 29th of the Cleveland Press about Mr. Hynek, Dr. Hynek.
Yes.
Charges that the American science or scientist has demonstrated a form of provincialism in failing to tackle one of the great mysteries of the 20th century. And he warned that the attitudes of modern scientists toward UFOs parallel those of savants toward meteorites reported 150 years ago, when science ridiculed the notion that stones fell from the sky. And
oh, yes, that was one of the classic boo-boos of science. Even when some noted scientists saw these things fall, they assured these noted scientists that they were nuts, that there could be no stones falling from the sky because there were no stones in the sky.
Are you speaking of tektites?
No. Talking of meteorites.
Yeah, yeah.
1805, before they even admitted that the things existed,
yeah.
Although many eminent scientists had been present when they had fallen. But the science, orthodox science, would not accept it because it was contrary to their belief. There couldn't be any stones falling because there were none up there.
Well,
there can't be any UFOs coming down because there are none out there. It's very simple.
Well, I was wondering what your opinion was of this article. Has he had a change of heart?
No, let me point out to you that Dr. Hynek is a very fine gentleman. And Dr. Hynek, as an employee of the Air Force, has to make some statements with which he may not be in full accord, such as the notorious swamp gas statement that he had to hand out up at Michigan last spring.
He was, according to some statements he made in the presence of some network newsmen who passed them on to me, he was not at all in accord with that statement. But Hynek is a very intelligent man. He's a very honest man. And I think in view of some things that he said, including the statement that you're quoting, that he would like to see this whole thing thrown open to real research and real discussion and real disclosure. He can be a help, I'll tell you that.
That does clear up my doubts.
Yeah. He's the best man they've had yet.
Yes, that's right.
And thank you very much for calling.
Thank you very much.
Right. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Douglas.
Yes, sir.
I would like to ask Mr. Neff or your other gentleman.
Frank Edwards?
Mr. Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
But supposedly, though, I suppose it's been answered already, but I was wondering about this curious loss of film and the fogging of a film on the last two Gemini shots, whether this had to do with the sightings or not. In other words, like today shot, they said the last two films were lost, or one was fogged and one was lost, inadvertently.
Earl, are you familiar with that case?
I'm not familiar with that. I know frequently the contactees will conveniently lose a film. I heard that recently.
Well, you better explain to this gentleman who the contactees
are. The contactees are the people who claim they've been communicating with creatures from outer space, etc. But so far as this is concerned, I really don't know. I couldn't answer you. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I mean, on the... I know they had the walk in space with Commander White, but like on today's TV program, they were saying it's two films were lost, or one was lost on one shot, and one was badly fogged that they couldn't show it.
Well, I'll tell you, so many things could cause that, and particularly the normal radiation out there in space. Would have a tendency to fog film unless the camera had some kind of protection around it, probably a lead sheath. So I don't think that either Earl or I would be in a position to comment on that, because it could be due to so many things other than UFO activity.
Oh, well, what I was driving at, maybe they were busy photographing other things.
Yeah, well, that could be, could be, and they don't want to show the pictures to anybody, so they say we didn't get any.
Well, you were talking about loss of communication,
yeah.
And I was noticing today they said on a couple of shots where they didn't have too much talk between the ground, or at least it wasn't broadcast, between the ground and the space capsule.
Well, I think that would be a sort of a supposition until more facts were gathered.
Years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting Joe Walker, and I showed him some things that had been printed in Europe and then had them translated for him and sent them out to his home. Joe's the man who did that X-15 flight faster than any human in a plane, you know, and then, unfortunately, just very recently was killed. He was a great guy, and I had an interesting letter I received from him later. But while he was up near Seattle, Washington one time, he lectured and was highly criticized for it by NASA because he had spoken of the film that was taken through the gun camera, the pictures that were taken through the gun camera. And this country shushed it pretty quickly, but in Europe they played it up pretty fast because apparently there were some reporters there who had picked it up and then put in the European papers.
Wasn't he clear that he was followed by some object?
Well, he actually himself didn't see them, but
actually it was a rear view movie camera,
right?
And it photographed these objects coming up in back of the tail of his X-15 rocket plane.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, I believe, five of them. I've got the story there in the book. And they flew in echelon formation behind his plane. And the official explanation was that these were ice flakes. Well, now, educated ice flakes are something new in the field of aerial phenomena, especially educated ice flakes that can fly in formation behind a plane that's going 25 or 3,500 miles an hour.
And weren't they supposedly approaching the plane?
They kept their distance, and they maneuvered with him.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they followed the same maneuvers.
The oxygen and ice flakes don't maneuver like these did.
Mr. Douglas, there is one other thing that was bothering me, because before you were saying how on this one account back in the early 20s or rather going back with this in the 1800s,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. where this rather cumbersome object
yes.
was sighted.
Yes, sir.
And then going all the way back to up to the 20s, and these people said that they saw this object and they disappeared between that period of time, between
yes.
the 20s and the 40s.
Right.
In other words, they were just first attempting to contact Earth or fly through space or whatever they were doing. But I can't understand the speed of development between back in the 20s.
You mean in a 20-year period?
What?
You mean you think we're crediting them with too much technological improvement in a 20-year period?
Well, I can't. When I balance this, that account against accounts way back in the biblical times, for
yeah.
instance, that were cited, this is what's confusing me. In other words, some of those accounts seem as though they were more advanced then than they were during this period, during the 20s.
Well, no, I don't think so. And you must remember that technological development can sometimes come very fast. Don't forget now that 8 years ago, we could not get a 4-pound satellite off the launching pad. 8 years ago. And look what we're doing now.
You put one up, it was 8,200 pounds.
Yeah. And 8 years ago, we couldn't get that 4-pounder off the pad down there.
Mm-hmm.
Look what we've done in 8 years. Look what we'll be doing if we continue at this rate. Look what we'll be doing in 8 more years. And I don't think it's inconceivable at all that someone else could have made the same or even more impressive gains in 10 or 15 or 20 years.
And could I ask one question?
Yes, sir.
Gentlemen, like to conjecture whether it's these crafts possibly are interstellar or interstellar.
Dr. Hermann Oberth, the great German rocket scientist, said at the end of his investigation of these things for the West German government, and he made the statement in October of 54 at Innsbruck. He said that he and his scientific colleagues who had worked on that commission had come to the unanimous opinion that these things did not originate in our solar system, but that they had been coming here for a very long time. And I think that that's about as good a guess as anybody has made yet. And all the military men and scientists with whom I'm associated are of Oberth's opinion. They share the same view. No, they don't know where these things come from, but they've obviously been coming here sporadically, at least, for a long time.
Okay.
All right, so
yes,
thank you for calling.
Hello, Mr. Douglas.
Yes, sir.
Concerning the phenomenon of USOs, UFOs, it's...
Could you turn your radio down, sir?
Yes.
If you please, thank
it's
you.
It's been brought to my attention that through my observations that possibly from the numerous sightings I've seen over or heard of over the Great Lakes region and the Great Plains area, that these sightings, these UFOs have a tendency to be seen in an area where there's a lot of sand and a lot of pure or fresh water. Now, is there any information from...
Well, now, are you referring to a seeming preponderance of sightings in the past in the southwest?
Right, here and also around the Great Lakes region here.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that the real reason these things are seen more frequently in, say, the Midwest and the Great Plains states and the southwest, they're seen more frequently in those areas because the viewing conditions, the seeing conditions are better. Around big cities, say New York City, you, for one thing, you've got a lot of haze there. Another thing, you've got a lot of light in the air. The viewing conditions are poor. And I don't know that there's any reason to believe that these things have any affinity for either fresh water or sand, but they do have a tendency to be seen better where the viewing conditions for us are better.
I see.
Also, wasn't there, some years ago, in the late 40s and in the 50s when there was some atomic testing going on in the Southwest, wouldn't this have been a valid reason for their being a preponderance?
Well, they did visit. They did visit the White Sands Lardo area, and they also did visit Hanford soon after we got started there, and. It may be pure coincidence, but they appeared in numbers 1 year after man fired his first atomic device. Now, whether they came as a result of the tremendous disturbance and the radiation sent out by those devices, and no one can say at this point.
Oh, let me stop you there.
Yes.
Let me stop you right there, because that's an interesting point. What is one light year away from the Earth?
6 trillion miles a light year.
6 trillion miles. I just thought I'd mention it.
Maybe somebody's sitting out there 6 trillion miles away waiting.
Oh, what I was also wondering, you know, if there's so much research being done now and the technical advancements that have been made with silicone is a type of, making transistor circuits and so forth like this. I just wondered if possibly that these UFOs were using the sand as a source of energy or something of this nature. And I guess there's really no evidence of it today.
Well, Dr. Opeth and other scientists who expressed themselves on the possible means of propulsion used by these craft have all been unanimous in stating that, in their opinion, they propelled themselves by distorting the gravitational field. This would be in conformity with Einstein's unified field theory, and this is also probably the reason that we are spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to find out what gravity is and how to use it. And if we ever find this out, our space travel problems will be largely solved, and these multi-million-dollar firecrackers that we use to get off of Cape Kennedy will be relegated to the field of the ox cart.
Now, when you talk about this anti-gravity research, how close do you think we are to that?
Hobart said that by 1970, men would be going to the moon in electrically propelled devices. They asked him if he meant ion propulsion. He said, no, I do not. I mean electrically propelled. So I presume that Obreth, who made that statement just after he left 5 years at Huntsville, Alabama, at the Redstone Arsenal, I imagine that he made that on the basis of information that he gained there.
Man has certainly conquered the problem with G-forces. In the whole larger picture of space travel, which has to include gravitational freedom, ultimately, according to everything I've heard, that it must be that we're simply doing the groundwork now, the experimental work that is required to find out what the human reaction is to travel. And once this gravity problem is overcome, it would seem to me that a lot of questions that we have about the rapid acceleration potential of so-called unidentified flying objects, the weird patterns that it chooses to fly, the sudden changes of direction, all of these things are explainable through gravity.
Yes, through the distortion of the gravitational field. If we could do that, as these things apparently do it, then we'd find that many of the problems that we have now would be no longer in existence.
I sometimes think that I've come very, very close to it on this program, in as much as I've been up in the air so many times on this program, seemingly without any help.
Do you hover? Have you noticed, Alan, whether you hover?
No, I go up and then suddenly reverse the field and come crashing back down again. Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
Don't you believe, gentlemen, that our president has a responsibility to the American public if there is more than just conversation concerning unidentified flying objects? It's my opinion that he would have a grave responsibility in this area. And I have to conclude that it evidently isn't quite as far-reaching or serious thing as you gentlemen seem to propose with the lack of this information coming.
Well, wait a minute. Right in keeping with what you're saying, the president would also have an obligation to carry out the policies which his predecessors had agreed on with the National Safety Council. And if he carried out those policies and maintained the secrecy that they advocate, he would be doing his job.
Well,
and that's exactly what's happening.
Well, the State National Safety Council, I don't quite understand.
National Security Council, pardon.
Oh.
Yeah. And I wasn't thinking of Carr. Right?
Yeah.
And it was President
you had me zooming off again.
And it was President Eisenhower who said that he wanted everything that was not classified to be released to the public. And they said, yes, Mr. President, and immediately punched it classified.
Yeah, they classified everything in connection with these things.
Well, then, are you suggesting that he's derelict in his responsibility?
Not at all. I'm suggesting that he is carrying out his obligations in conformity with the policies which the President has agreed upon with the National Security Council.
Oh, yes, that old edict that Eisenhower made.
Well, it was before him, really.
I think you'd have to stretch imagination to the elastic limit to produce anything political out of this discussion tonight. I don't think that either Mr. Edwards or Mr. Neff have any interest in criticizing the President or any particular interest in criticizing the Air Force. Now, I would suggest that there's nothing political involved here at all, but simply a matter of policy, and no one is very clear on where that policy was originated or just why it has been perpetuated, if indeed it is a policy.
Well, I think that they have actually, Alan, to some degree, made a joke out of some Air Force pronouncements. I don't know if you want to refer to that as criticism or not. Frankly, I don't pretend to be informed on this matter at all, and it's just what I thought is a logical question that our president, if this is such a grave issue, I would feel would have a very definite responsibility to inform the American public. That's
well, let me say this. I've been close to this subject for 20 years, and I know that the Air Force was given this assignment. It's a very difficult assignment, and as I said earlier in the program, I think they have done a good job with a very difficult assignment within the restrictions which were placed on them. And these restrictions were placed from the very top. They cover not only the Air Force, but all the military. So they had to originate somewhere around or in the National Security Council. And if the National Security Council thinks that this should be done in a certain way, you may be sure that the President will cooperate fully with that conclusion. And I think that's what's happened. I don't think there's anything political about it.
I haven't suggested that there is.
No, that's right.
I haven't suggested that there is.
That's right, and I agree with you. And I think that answers your question.
No.
That he is simply, regardless of who the President is, he is simply concurring in the policy which was set up and set up at a very high level. And I think that answers your question, because I think that really is why it's done the way it's done.
Yes, well, it does, Frank. But you did make one statement I thought was rather funny. You thought it would be impossible for three men to spend $10 million. Well, I don't know whether you looked over the poverty program. But I think that there's been quite a few million spent by some people.
Of course, one of these guys was a sergeant. Would they let him spend that kind of money?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
It's amazing to me how we have come, really, from intergalactic travel to the poverty program, but we have.
Oh, well, Alan, you know what? It's fun in the day, you know.
Yes, and it's been quite a day. Thank you very much for calling.
Alan, that's traveling faster than light, you know.
Yes, and logic, perhaps. Talking tonight with Frank Edwards. Edwards is an experience for me, because Mr. Edwards, along with Earl Neff tonight, certainly articulates the situation beautifully and tells us of a great many things that concern them and a great many things which remain unanswered. The fact that these answers seem, these questions seem to want answers, is something I don't think any of us can really ignore. Let me say that while I have never seen what could be described as an unidentified flying object, I also don't spend very much time looking for them, and I have not put in the years of research and study and careful sifting of facts and of analysis that Frank has put in, that Earl Neff has put in, therefore, my position is that I choose to sit and listen. I think it would be a mistake for any of us not to. I also think that there is an odd kind of put-down that we have had in programs on the past hasn't happened tonight. It's a strange kind of a put-down, Frank, on this kind of discussion from certain kinds of people. Do you run across this at all?
Yes, yes. As I told that lady a while ago, this is a field where the only skeptics are the uninformed.
Mm-hmm.
And the more uninformed they are, the more skeptical they are. But after you have done any reasonable measure of research in this field, you become aware that there is a great deal more to it than you would think from reading the various official statements that are put out, dismissing these things as luminous flying ants and so forth. And you, after you have seen one yourself, there's no question in your mind that you have seen something very unusual.
You know, actually, the swamp gas thing may have been a help to the people like yourself, because I think it turned off a great many people, the swamp gas theory, Professor.
Oh, Frank. Sure. That did more to discredit the Air Force as a source of information on this subject. And I had a feeling that perhaps they did it deliberately, because I've had a feeling from statements that were made to me by some prominent people in the Air Force in recent years that they would like to be rid of this thing, that they would like to get out from under this and turn it over to somebody else. It's not a military problem. There's no hostility from these things. As Dr. Hynek and Dr. Carl Sagan and others said to the Congressional Investigations Committee earlier this year, this is a purely scientific problem and should be dealt with on that basis. And I think that the Air Force may have done a few things like the swamp gas story and some of the others to get itself out of the business, to get back into its own field of endeavor and turn this thing over to somebody else.
Hello.
Yes, sir?
Yes, sir.
This is Roger Schrack in Mansfield, Ohio.
Yes, sir.
And I've been listening to your discussion, and I thought maybe Mr. Edwards would want to comment on the author, Raymond Bernard, that wrote the Hollow Earth. A while ago, I noticed that he said that perhaps these UFOs weren't necessarily interplanetary, and I was wondering if maybe he had that in mind when he made that statement.
Well, I'm going to hang on that question breathlessly, because I'm dying to know what Frank Edwards says, too.
Well, I didn't exactly have Mr. Bernard or the Hollow Earth book in mind when I made that statement. However, I'm glad you asked the question, because in one of the earlier editions of his book, Bernard started off by saying, "My good friend Frank Edwards. I never saw or heard of the man until he wrote this book." The theory of the Hollow Earth is a very, very old one. In this country, it got started with a man named John Sims, who was a farmer in Ohio, and he was a captain in the Army during the War of 1812. And Captain Sims got hit over the head with a musket butt. And he was never the same after that. He couldn't remember which way to lead his men toward the enemy. And he sometimes led them in the wrong direction. And so they sent Captain Sims home, and he sat on the courthouse lawn and whittled out hollow wooden balls, which he told other spit and whittle fellows around there were models of the hollow earth. He also pestered members of Congress and scientists for years with letters urging them to finance an expedition to the North Pole, which he would lead, of course, Captain Sims. And he would lead it and to find the hole where people were going in and out of the hollow earth. The theory is old, and I think that Sims' condition due to that blow on the head probably accounted for his enthusiasm for it. I have always felt that the theory of a hollow earth would only appeal to people with hollow heads.
I think that puts it pretty clearly.
Yeah, then you'd say that Bernard's statement that the Naval Department has knowledge that Admiral Byrd flew into the hollow earth is all just fiction, right?
Yes, that's right.
All right.
Because I grant you that Admiral Byrd did not fly into any hollow earth.
Well, I just thought I'd call up that.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad the point came up, because it's one of the things that bugs me. I read about this book in magazines. It's advertised in a number of different publications.
That outfit that sells that book has a mail drop up there in the hall of this building that they list as their headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
They have a kid that goes around there a couple times a day and picks up the mail. And that's the publishing company.
And they're selling the books.
Oh, they sure are.
Well, I put down the whole Hollow Earth thing. And apparently, it's there is not just one book available on
it. Oh, no. He's got a dozen books and all about that same caliber.
Yeah. There is just one little thing I would like to read. Do I have the author's permission to quote?
Well, oh, please do. You're going to quote from that great book, Flying
Saucer
Series.
Yes, that great book, Flying Saucer Series Business, which incidentally doesn't need much help from me because it's number 7 on the best-selling list. 6 now?
6, yes, sir.
It's coming up. The bestsellers list of nonfiction, and that means it's doing pretty well. I think it's deservedly so, too, because it's written so well. But there's something here that that really I think you ought to know about. It's one of the most significant parts of the book. Comes right up at the beginning, almost, on page 18. And this is the story of a book called The Book of Design, which is a chronicle of ancient India, a translation of which, I understand, Frank, you were able to obtain through a relative that went over to...
Yes, this fellow was a doctor at Georgetown College, a nephew of mine.
The book is a compilation of legend, Frank writes, passed down through the ages before men were able to write, and finally gathered in a manuscript form by the ancient scholars who preserved them for us. They tell of a small group of beings who came to Earth many thousands of years ago in a metal craft which first went around the Earth several times before landing. These beings, says the book, lived to themselves and were revered by the humans among whom they had settled. But eventually, differences arose among them and they divided their numbers, several of the men and women and some children settling in another city where they were promptly installed as rulers by the awe-stricken populace. Separation did not bring peace to these people, and finally their anger reached a point where the ruler of the original city took with him a small number of his warriors, and they rose into the air in a huge shining metal vessel. While there were many leagues from the city of their enemies, they launched a great shining lance that rode on a beam of light. It burst apart in the city of their enemies with a great ball of flame that shot up to the heavens, almost to the stars. All those in the city were horribly burned, and even those who were not in the city but nearby were burned also. Those who looked upon the lance and the ball of fire were blinded forever afterward. Those who entered the city on foot became ill and died. Even the dust of the city was poisoned, as were the rivers that flowed through it. Men dared not go near it, and it gradually crumbled into dust and was forgotten by men. When the leader saw what he had done to his own people, he retired to his palace and refused to see anyone. There he gathered about him those of his warriors who remained, and their wives and their children, and they entered into their vessels and rose one by one into the sky and sailed away, nor did they return. When you think about that and read Frank's account, his opinion afterward, you see how close that comes to rocketry, to nuclear destruction, and this ages and ages ago in an ancient Indian culture.
It's estimated that that was about 6,000 years before Christ.
Frank Edwards, thank you very much for giving us something to think about tonight. And I would like to wish you the very best of luck with your book, Shaking Hands.
Thank you, Alan.
It's been a great pleasure to see you.
Thank you, sir.
Now, I would just like to leave the audience with a thought, if I may. I hope the host can be given his forgiven his tendency to fantasize, but I find this final observation of in the book that we just made irresistible. Wouldn't it be wild and exquisitely ironic if after all the sophistication of the 20th century, after all the God is dead theories and all the successful space shots, after all the advanced research into LSD and all the hipping up of mankind on DNA and RNA, it turned out that this planet really did host extraterrestrial visitors ages ago? What if it should turn out that through UFOs lies our contact with some valid or tangible kind of heaven, a reachable before death kind of heaven? What if it should turn out that some of our most ancient teachings and tellings were simply forms of UFO reports told in the non-technological terms of another age? Or go one step further, supposing the heaven that was told to people here on Earth by these allegedly extraterrestrial travelers turned out to be not so good after all, and the heaven that we think of in our minds is really the heaven right here on Earth. What strange and wonderful things we can encounter in the future and look forward to.